And I did for years. But there were problems, too. She drove a wedge between me and the kids. Yes, Vivi thinks. So much time has passed that Vivi has let go of most of her resentment toward Amy. Amy was young and impressionable that first summer when she worked for JP, and he took advantage of her. She's invested 10 years in him without any promise of a commitment. Surely she wants a ring. But she settled for nothing, and now JP is tossing her out. She was always jealous of Vivi. She was so busy being jealous of Vivi that she never fully became her own person. Back in September, I bought her an engagement ring. But every time I looked at it, I panicked. So I returned it to the jeweler in Boston. I've lost whatever feelings I had for Amy. Something I've willfully ignored for the past year or two. But now that Vivi's gone, I need to be honest with myself. I don't want to spend the rest of my days with Amy Van Pelt. What did she think about you coming over here? Savannah asks. She couldn't have been too happy. She's out with her friend Lorna, JP says. She put on a vampy dress. I think she was trying to make me jealous, and maybe 5 years ago, or even last year, I would have been jealous. But now I just hope that when she goes out, she meets someone else. Wow, Savannah says. What about you? JP asks. Are you seeing anyone? Coach of an NBA team? CEO of Colgate Palmolive? Head of surgery at Mass General? No one right now, Savannah says. There was the crown prince of a minor European nation, but we called it quits. JP laughs, and Savannah wheels him toward the hallway. Go home, JP. At the front door, there's another hug, and Vivi thinks, kiss her. It's not too late. If you're breaking up with Amy anyway, just kiss her. They separate, and JP disappears out the door, down the friendship stairs, and into the dark night. Savannah closes the door behind him, then leans against it and smiles. She likes him, Vivi thinks. Maybe? You could have used one of your nudges, you know. Suddenly, Martha is sitting on the green velvet chaise with an Hermes scarf wrapped around her entire head like she's a fortune teller. It would have worked. They were close. I'm the novelist here, Vivi says. Let's give it another couple of chapters. Willa. Summer in Wee Bit starts to take on a rhythm, a routine. And this keeps Willa from falling into a yawning hole of despair. Willa wakes up early every morning and takes her herbal tea to the back deck where she watches the sun turn the sky a pearlescent pink. She doesn't eat anything. She can't. Her morning sickness hovers around her like a green miasma. She welcomes it. Has she ever been this sick before? She thinks not. She's constantly on the lookout for ways that this pregnancy is different. Some days she drives to work, and other days she bikes the 6 miles into town. The ride is picturesque, bucolic, over the simple bridge that spans the neck of Matticat Harbor, through the hamlet of Matticat, along the famed 27 curves that lead past the creek and the turtling pond, until she's cruising the final mile to the flagpole at Caton Circle, which marks the top of Main Street. Willa wants to avoid the cobblestones in her condition, so she bikes the long way around, New Lane to Westchester, which is, if anyone is interested in Nantucket's history, the oldest street on the island, to North Beach to the back door of the Whaling Museum. Willa's office is air-conditioned. She does not have to guide the VIP group tours and interact with the public until she's feeling up to it emotionally. So she sits at her desk and tends to her administrative duties. Final approval of all publications, overseeing publicity and marketing, scheduling maintenance and repairs on the NHA's 14 properties. After work, Willa usually takes a walk on the beach. If Rip gets home early, he'll go with her and they'll hold hands for a while, then stop, then rejoin hands. Rip likes to pick up shells and horseshoe crab carcasses and dried mermaid purses, He can identify shorebirds, oyster catchers, the endangered piping plover, and his favorite, the sanderlings. For dinner, they either get takeout from Millie's or grill out back. Burgers, steaks, chicken, thick slabs of swordfish. Protein. Willa craves it. Has she craved protein this way in the past? Willa goes to bed early, often before it's fully dark. The exhaustion hits her like something that falls out of the sky. This doesn't tell the whole story, of course. It skips over the 17 times a day Willa uses the bathroom, sometimes to relieve her bladder, other times just to cry, quietly at work, and then with abandon, loud and ugly when she's in wee bit by herself. Her mother is gone. Sometimes when Willa cries at night in bed, Rip will hold her and whisper into her hair. He says he would do anything to make the pain go away. He would take it from her and endure it himself if he could. But Rip can't make things better. Nobody can make things better. Willa loved her mother so, so much, and now her mother is dead. Willa is aware that everyone loses a loved one eventually. It's part of being human, and everyone must bear the pain alone. Willa won't say that Pamela showing up with the news that she suspects Zach of having an affair was welcome, but it has certainly served as a distraction. On that first day, when Pamela drove out to Wee Bit to confide in Willa, they ended up sitting at the picnic table out back. Willa said, "What exactly makes you think this?" Pamela lifted her sunglasses to the top of her head and stared into the dunes. Willa noticed some strands of silver in the white blonde streak of Pamela's hair. Her face was tan from playing so much tennis, and there were lines around her blue eyes. Willa couldn't recall ever being this close to her sister-in-law before, because Pamela had always held herself literally at arm's length. But now the barrier was coming down. "He's been disappearing at night," Pamela said. "Midnight, 1 o'clock. He claims when he has insomnia, he drives out to the beach. He says watching the waves makes him sleepy." Willa agreed. This was suspicious behavior. "Have you checked his phone?" Willa asked. "I can't check his account to see what calls he made," Pamela said. "His phone is issued by the FAA. They pay the bill. He can use it for personal calls too, of course, but there's no way I can access the account." "But you could check his actual phone?" "If I knew the passcode, but I don't." "He has a passcode?" "Everyone has a passcode, Willa." "I don't," Willa said. "Rip doesn't. Rip and I are in and out of each other's phones all the time." "Well, you guys aren't normal," Pamela said. Willa relaxed. This, at least, was a Pamela she recognized. And Willa knew that she and Rip had an unusually close relationship. She was proud of it, thank you very much. "Have you noticed anything else?" Willa asked. "He's happy," Pamela said. And again, her eyes brimmed with tears. "And that's what makes me dead sure. He whistles. He sings." "Couldn't this happiness be due to something else?" Willa asked. "He has insomnia and sneaks out of the house after I'm asleep. But he's happier than I've seen him in years." Willa had to admit, this equation had only one likely answer. "What are you going to do?" she asked. "I'm going to find out who it is," Pamela said. Willa is intrigued, and it pains her to have no one to share this with. She can't tell Rip. He works with Pamela every day, and though he's normally a vault when it comes to secrets, Pamela is a weak spot for him. He would break, and Willa would be deemed untrustworthy. She misses her mother. If her mother were alive, Willa would confide in her. Can she tell Carson? They've become closer since Vivi died. Carson texts to check in at Willa's request, and Willa has invited Carson over to Wee Bit for dinner the next time she has a night off. But Carson doesn't care for any of the Bonhams. She thinks they're cold and superior. And if Willa told her that Pamela thought Zach was having an affair, she would roll her eyes and say, Girl, who cares? Willa can maybe tell Savannah, but Savannah is doing so much already, trying to settle Vivi's estate. Willa offered to take over the admin of the Vivian Howe Memorial Facebook page, and Savannah seemed relieved. She said, "Look at the message from someone named Brett Caspian, would you? He claims he was your mother's boyfriend in high school." "Mom didn't have a boyfriend in high school," Willa said. "Just look, please, Willie," Savannah said. The Vivian Howe Memorial Facebook page has over 200 new messages since Willa last checked. Vivi starts scrolling through the messages. So much love, so much heartbreak. One woman, Eden F. from Niagara, New York, says she can't stop crying and has personally called the Nantucket Police Department to demand justice. This seems like a bit much, but Vivi inspired this kind of devotion. She shared unvarnished looks at her life. She would video the kitchen when there were dishes in the sink or the hallway when there was a pile of stuff at the bottom of the stairs, and her readers appreciated these details. "We all have dirty dishes, dirty laundry, stuff waiting at the bottom of the stairs, even our favorite novelist." Vivi's readers felt like they knew her. Of course they're upset. Willa thinks that finding the message from Brett Caspian might be a needle in a haystack quest, but only a few posts in, there it is. A message sent that very morning. "I hope someone in Vivi's family will read this. I was able, with a few phone calls to the publisher, to receive an advance copy of Golden Girl. In high school, I wrote a song called Golden Girl that was inspired by Vivi. She was my girlfriend from September 1986 to August 1987. Once I read the book, I saw that she used more than just the title. She used our story. I'm going to go out on a limb and leave my phone number here in hopes that someone from the family will contact me so we can discuss this further. Thank you. Brett Caspian." Willa reads the message twice. Brett Caspian wrote a song called Golden Girl that was inspired by Vivi? Vivi used their story in her new novel? Willa has read only two of her mother's 13 novels. She prefers nonfiction, biography in particular, but this is two more than Carson and Leo have read. Willa knows the premise of Golden Girl. It involves a high school romance and a song called Golden Girl, but she thought it was made up. Willa Googles Brett Caspian and Golden Girl. She gets a handful of hits about her mother's novel, and the rest are about a sitcom featuring old ladies. Vivi never once mentioned that she'd had a boyfriend in high school. She studied and had two good friends, Stephanie and Gina, whom she sometimes talked about but wasn't in touch with, as far as Willa knew. "You're a fraud, Brett Caspian," Willa thinks. And yet, she writes his number down, because what if he's not a fraud? What if he opens a door to a part of her mother's life that Willa knew nothing about? What if Willa learns about a secret Vivi kept until her death? This is exactly like something that would happen in one of her mother's novels. The line between real life and fiction is becoming blurry indeed. Even dialing the numbers feels illicit. Willa reminds herself that Savannah asked her to check this guy out and that she's merely doing her due diligence with the Vivian Howe Memorial Facebook page. He doesn't answer, and his voicemail is an automated recording. She leaves a message. "My name is Willa Bonham. I'm Vivian Howe's daughter. I saw your Facebook message, and I'm calling you as requested." She hangs up, and not 2 seconds later, her phone rings with Brett Caspian's number on the caller ID. Oh boy. Willa stares at it, one hand holding the phone, one hand resting on her belly. "Hello?" she says.
"Hello, this is Brett Caspian. You just called?"
"Yes," Willa says. The voice is appealing, she decides, strong and a little raspy. "My name is Willa. I'm Vivi Howe's daughter."
"Oh, man,"
Brett says. He emits a whistling breath.
"I can't believe this. I'm, well, first off, I'm sorry about your mom.
Thank you, Willa says, because although this feels awkward, it's what one is supposed to say.
So listen, I'm not even sure where to start. I went to high school with Vivi.
And where was that? Willa asks.
There's a hesitation. Parma High School? In Parma, Ohio? You do know that's where your mother went to high school.
Willa laughs. Yes, I know. I just wanted to make sure that you knew. Because she never mentioned a boyfriend in high school. She said she was a nerd.
Brett chuckles at this. Yeah, she was a nerd. She was just about the most beautiful nerd you've ever seen. Always with her nose in a book or raising her hand with the right answer.
And you were her boyfriend?
Senior year, yes. That was the year her father died.
Okay, Willa thinks. This guy is for real. Her legs tingle, and suddenly she has to pee. I'm sorry, but she didn't tell me about you.
Why was that? Willa wonders. Did she not want JP to be jealous?
Or was it for some other reason?
Things got complicated at the end, and the breakup was hard on both of us. She went off to Duke, and I moved to LA, and I never saw her again. I live in Knoxville, Tennessee now. I'm a hotel manager, and I play a little guitar. But I'm not into all that Facebook stuff or social media, so I haven't kept in touch with anyone from home except the guys in my old band. Those guys held a big grudge against Vivi for reasons I can tell you about later, and we never bring her name up. Except last week, one of the guys, Roy, said he heard through his sister that Vivi had died. He told me she was a writer. So I looked her up and I saw her new book was called Golden Girl, which was the name of my song.
Your song?
The one I wrote in high school for Vivi. I just finished the book last night and, wow, so much of what she wrote was based on what really happened with us.
I haven't read the book yet, Willa admits.
I was hoping I could talk to you about it.
Isn't that what we're doing now? Willa wonders.
I have vacation time saved up, so I was thinking about driving up there maybe week after next. I'll stay in Hyannis at the Holiday Inn. That's the company I work for. Then I'll take the ferry over to meet you.
You want to come here? Willa says. To Nantucket?
I have pictures of your mom and me, Brett says. I pulled them up from the depths of my trunk and we look so young. I'd like to show them to you.
Willa isn't sure what to say to this guy. He seems legit, and maybe he was Vivi's boyfriend in high school in Parma, Ohio. It was a time in her life that Vivi almost never talked about. It was as though Vivi's personal history started her first week at Duke when she met Savannah. Everything before that is literally sketchy. Line drawings without any color or details filled in. I have a place you can stay on Nantucket if you want to make it a real vacation and explore the island a bit. She clamps her mouth shut, trying to imagine what Rip will say when she tells him she's invited a complete stranger weirdo from Vivi's Facebook page to stay in their house on Quaker Road.
The Holiday Inn will be fine, Brett says. I'm used to it. So how about 2 weeks from tomorrow?
Okay, Willa says. She feels strangely excited. She's getting back a part of Vivi that she hadn't even known existed. That sounds great. Keep me posted on your travel plans and I'll come pick you up from the boat.
You got it, Brett Caspian says. Thank you for calling me, Willa. It'll be such an honor to meet you. One of Vivi's kids. It's said on Wikipedia that she has three?
Yes, I have a sister and a brother.
I remember her saying she wanted five kids, and she was going to name them after her favorite authors.
He pauses.
Are you named after an author?
Oh, Willa says. Yes, I'm named after Willa Cather. And my sister and brother are named for authors too.
See there? Brett says. How could I know that if I weren't for real?
This is exciting, Willa thinks. Brett Caspian will come and he will tell me Vivi's secret history. Vivi. Thank goodness she saved her nudges. Martha, Vivi cries out. She goes to the green door, but she's too afraid to touch it. What if Martha takes away a precious week of viewing? Vivi throws herself across the velvet chaise and stares up at the pattern of light that the Moroccan chandelier casts on the ceiling. Normally, this calms her, but not today. A second later, Martha materializes. She picks an orange off the dwarf tree and takes a seat on the white enamel bean-shaped coffee table with her clipboard on her lap. A peak of scarf is visible at the top of her muumuu. What is it, Vivian?
I can't let Brett Caspian go to Nantucket. I have to use one of my nudges.
Martha puts on her drugstore reading glasses and checks her clipboard. I would strongly advise against that.
Well, sorry, not sorry. I'm doing it, Vivi says.
Very slowly, Martha peels the orange. The scent is sublime, and Vivi can see the juicy flesh of the orange as Martha pulls apart the segments. The color is like stained glass, like a jewel. The odd thing is that Vivi tried to eat one of the oranges herself, but when she peeled it, it was desiccated, practically dust. Martha knows how things work, and Vivi doesn't. It isn't fair.
I'm making an executive decision on this one, Martha says.
She pops a succulent orange segment into her mouth, but does not offer one to Vivi. He's coming. Brett Caspian coming to Nantucket? Meeting her kids? There must be a reason Martha made an executive decision.
You're going to have to learn to trust me, Martha had said at the beginning.
Okay, Vivi thinks with great reluctance. I'll trust you. Vivi is flattered that Brett remembers so much about her. He remembers that she wanted to have 5 kids and name them after her favorite authors. That night, while everyone is sleeping, Vivi travels back 2 decades. It's February on Nantucket, raw and wet with winds that sound like a chainsaw. Vivi and JP have 2 daughters, Willa, named for Willa Cather, and Carson, named for Carson McCullers. Everyone mistakes her for a boy. Vivi used to think that she wanted 5 children. She was so naive. She's hanging on to her sanity now only because Willa, at 3, is so mature that she will sit in her small rocking chair alongside Vivi's bigger rocking chair and read her picture books while Vivi nurses the baby. And she will put headphones on and listen to her baby Spanish tapes while the baby cries. 23 hours a day, the baby is either nursing or crying. The only hour that the baby will sleep soundly is the hour after JP comes home from work at Island Fog Real Estate. Carson's cheek hits her father's shoulder and she instantly conks out. This, at least, gives Vivi a chance to make dinner.
We were spoiled with Willa, JP says.
Yes, Willa was a perfect baby. She slept all the time, peacefully, face up in her bassinet and then her crib. She comforted herself without a pacifier. She nursed beautifully but never minded a bottle. Carson, however, has both colic and reflux. She eats, she spits up, she cries. Vivi has her on the breast, gives her breast milk from a bottle, gives her formula from a bottle. There's no difference, no improvement. She's happier sleeping on her stomach, but what kind of irresponsible parent puts a baby to sleep on her stomach? There are days Vivi cries right along with Carson, but she lets herself do that only when Willa is napping. She tries not to think of the girls as good kid, bad kid, or even as easy kid, difficult kid, because what if these labels follow them into adolescence and then adulthood? They're just so different, Vivi says. How did this happen?
Happens all the time, JP says, like a man who is an expert on siblings, although he's an only child, just like Vivi.
One night that Vivi thinks might be the worst night ever, Carson is screaming bloody murder and her face is as red as a Bartlett's Farm tomato. Willa is doing this new low-key whimpering thing, which is even more grating on Vivi's nerves than the baby's crying.
and JP is off-island taking the test for his real estate license, so Vivi has no backup. Vivi gets an idea for a novel about two sisters. It comes to her whole, like a neatly wrapped present. The Dune Daughters. Charlotte and Evangeline. Their father is a scalper. He raises them by himself in a dilapidated fishing shack out in the dunes by Long Pond. One sister marries a local boy, and the other marries a rich summer kid. Who will be happier? Willa and the baby don't fall asleep until well past midnight. But Vivi, thinking about the novel's plot, doesn't care. When they're finally quiet, she grabs a notebook and a pen and brews a cup of herbal tea. She wants coffee, but there can be no caffeine while nursing. She inhales the silence and exhales words onto the page. It is just that easy, that natural. It feels like breathing. 2 hours later, like clockwork, the baby cries and Vivi's milk lets down, but she keeps writing. Miraculously, Carson stops crying on her own. The front of Vivi's nightgown is soaked, but she doesn't care. She keeps writing. 8 months later, the first draft of The Dune Daughters is finished. Vivi wrote it during the girls' nap time and late at night. She learned to live with less sleep the same way people learn to live with less food during wartime. On the night she completes the novel, she wakes JP up by sitting on the edge of the bed and kissing the crook of his neck. JP has endured one hell of a summer. As low man at Island Fog Real Estate, he was assigned the least desirable rentals, which always seemed to attract the most demanding families. JP spent 12 consecutive summer weekends meeting people with keys, chasing down plumbers to fix leaky outdoor showers, running to Yates Gas because the propane tank on the grill was empty. JP likes his boss, Eddie Pancik. Everyone on the island calls him Fast Eddie, but JP knows he would be happier if he started his own business and could be his own boss. "Don't quit," Vivi told him all summer long. "We need the money." They used the fund set up for JP by his grandparents to put a down payment on the house on Surfside, and the rest went into a contingency account, which is almost depleted. Kids are expensive. Life is expensive. "I finished the novel," Vivi says once JP's eyes open. He props himself up on his elbows. "You did? Just now?" "I can't tell if it's any good," Vivi says. She has given the novel a dozen read-throughs and sometimes thinks it's inspired and other times thinks it's cheesy and cliched. A vanity project by an overtired housewife. "I'm too close to it." JP pulls Vivi to him and kisses the part in her hair. "Of course it's good," he says. "You wrote it." When Vivi tells the women in her Mommy and Me group that she has finished writing a novel, half of them are skeptical about its prospects, the other half patronizing. JP assures her those mothers are just envious because Vivi found the time to do something for herself. That's part of it, certainly, Vivi thinks, but it's also silly to expect people to get excited about a book that isn't published. How will she ever get published? Vivi has remained in touch all these years with famous author, the one who taught the workshop that Vivi attended in high school. In a letter, Vivi asks famous author what she should do with her manuscript. He calls her, taking her completely by surprise. She included her phone number in the letter, but never dreamed he'd use it. He gives Vivi his own agent's name and address. "Send it to Jody with a big note on top that says, 'I referred you. I want full credit for discovering you. Hear me? You're going to be successful, Vivian. I could tell that 13 years ago. You've got something." A week after Vivi sends the manuscript, Jody Partridge calls to say she would be honored to represent Vivi. "This book is so summery. It makes me want to move to Nantucket and live my best, beachiest life." Vivi eyes the inside of her house. There are doll clothes and Cheerios all over the floor and a juice box, not even organic, leaking onto the coffee table. Vivi had big plans of taking the girls on a walk through the moors. The foliage is changing colors, and the October sun makes everything look like it's been dipped in gold. But it's 2 o'clock, and Vivi is still in her yoga pants. "I predict we're going to have a bunch of competing offers on this," Jody says, "which will drive the price up. With luck, it'll go for a pretty penny."
"A pretty penny," Vivi tells JP the second he walks through the door.
She grabs both of his hands and starts hopping up and down.
"A pretty penny!"
But something is wrong. JP looks dejected. Like his dog died. They don't have a dog. Or like he got fired.
"Is everything okay?" Vivi says. "Did you get fired?"
It's true that JP hasn't generated a lot of income for Island Fog, but building a client list takes time.
"No," JP says.
"Then what's wrong?"
"My mother bought half of Old South Wharf is what's wrong. She bought 5 of those cottages along the docks to the tune of $3.5 million.
"What?" Vivi says.
"And she used Eddie Pancik as her broker," JP says. "Instead of me, her only son. Do you know how much commission you get for $3.5 million?
Vivi doesn't know. And at the moment, she doesn't care. Would it be rude to brag about her good news now? Probably.
"What is Lucinda going to do with 5 cottages on Old South Wharf?"
"Rent them out," JP says. "She told me if I came up with a business plan, she would rent one to me at a discount. So, I was thinking about a yacht concierge business. I could cater to all the huge boats in the summer."
"You'll be right back to picking up dry cleaning," Vivi says, "and you don't want that. What about something else?"
"The other idea I had was for a boutique wine shop," JP says.
"What about something inexpensive that everyone wants?" Vivi says. "Like ice cream."
"And compete with the juice bar?" JP says. "Are you high?"
It's a narrow opening, but she's going to take it.
"I am high, actually," Vivi says.
This gets JP's attention.
"I got an agent, JP. Jody called and she likes the book and she thinks we'll get a bunch of competing offers." Those were her exact words. "She says with luck, it'll go for a pretty penny."
JP gives Vivi a blank stare, and Vivi wonders if he'll be able to put aside his own woes for a minute and celebrate Vivi. A huge smile breaks across JP's face, and he lifts Vivi off the ground. She wraps her legs around him, and they kiss like they haven't kissed since before Carson was born. Carson starts to cry in the pack and play, and Willa's screen time needs to come to an end. But Vivi doesn't care. She is so happy. Nothing in this world feels as good as hope. Carson. On Saturday night at the Oyster Catcher, Carson drops a pint glass filled with whale's tail pale ale. It slips right through her fingers and shatters against the concrete floor behind the bar. No one is hurt, but there are shards, and the beer splashes everywhere. Carson is too busy to stop.
"Clean that up," she barks at the barback, Jamie, girl.
Carson knows that Jamie hates her, so Carson recently bought her a $150 gift card to Lemon Press as a thank you for having my back, smoothies and acai bowls for days. But now Carson is right back to square one. Less than an hour later, Carson drops a tray of glasses and share plates, which makes such a loud, nerve-splintering sound that a hush comes over the entire restaurant for one moment of pristine humiliation. This time, Carson crouches down to clean the mess up herself. And when Jamie comes to help, Carson says,
"Please don't. This was my screw-up."
She loses precious minutes, and by the time she's at her post again, there's a huge backup of orders. Jamie, boy, has been helping out by pulling drafts, but that's all he knows how to do.
"One customer at a time," Carson thinks.
That's the only way out of the weeds. The crowd will thin eventually. Vodka Cran, Vodka Soda, Sauvignon Blanc, dozen Wellfleets with extra horseradish. Suddenly, the GM, Nikki, is behind Carson, smiling while gritting her teeth.
George wants to see you in his office after service.
It was an accident, Nikki.
Just passing on a message, Carson.
Carson tries to focus. So many orders, so many faces, arms waving, hands thrusting money toward her in an attempt to get her attention. She tends to wait on men first, a terrible habit she's trying hard to break, so she looks for women. And as she's doing this, she sees Pamela Bonham Bridgman sitting at the end of the bar. Carson's heart crashes to the ground, just like the dropped tray, because what can Carson think but that Pamela knows and has chosen to confront Carson at work, where it will hurt the most? Then Carson sees Willa beside Pamela, and Willa is waving. She looks not exactly happy. None of them may ever look happy again. But she seems fine, normal-ish. What are they doing here? Why are they together? Willa hates Pamela. Everyone hates Pamela. Carson takes drink orders from every other female at the bar, and then every man. When she can ignore her sister and her lover's wife no longer, she says,
"Ladies, surprise, surprise, what can I get you?"
"Chardonnay with a side of ice," Pamela says.
"Cranberry seltzer with lime,"
Willa says.
"You guys eating?"
"There's no room at the bar," Willa says. "They told me it's a 90-minute wait for a table. Do you have any pull?"
Not tonight, Carson thinks. But she can't resist showing off in front of Pamela, so she approaches the hostess stand where Nikki is busy crushing people's dreams and says,
"It's my sister's first night out since my mom died. Any chance you can put her at table one?"
Table one is the two-top closest to the dunes at sunset. It's the best table at the Oyster Catcher. Nikki growls,
"I shouldn't, but I will. For her, though, not for you. The people are paying now. Tell her 5 minutes."
Carson hustles back to the bar.
5 minutes,
she says, handing the shard, the ice, and the seltzer over the counter.
"These drinks are on me."
"Thank you," Willa says.
But Carson doesn't care about Willa. She cares only about Pamela, who is gazing out over the beach, looking very alone among the sea of people. She accepts the Chardonnay without a word and doesn't even look at Carson.
I'm invisible to her, Carson thinks.
And although she's offended, she knows this is for the best. After service, Carson heads down the hall, past the retail shop and the restrooms, to George's office. The door is closed. Has she been saved? Is he gone for the night? Tomorrow, her drops will be forgotten. The service industry has a short memory, especially in a place like the Oyster Catcher, where there is never a quiet moment for reflection. Carson knocks.
"Enter!"
Carson swears under her breath and opens the door. George is at his desk, which is meticulously organized. Invoices on the left, order forms on the right, and in the center is a weekly calendar that shows the schedule, written always in pencil. Pencils are sharpened, kept points up in a mason jar. The computer behind the desk displays an old-school game of Tetris.
"Please sit down," George says.
There's a folding chair, known to the staff as the hot seat. Carson feels she should remain standing, but she's been on her feet since 3, so she gratefully collapses.
2 drops tonight, George says.
I know, I'm sorry. I don't have an excuse. I wasn't paying attention.
George tisks under his breath. George is universally loved at the Oyster Catcher and on Nantucket. He has worked in restaurants on the island for something like 40 years, managing at both the Straight Wharf and the White Elephant, and then running the grill at the Maya Comet Golf Club for a few years before buying the Oyster Catcher. Because George has worked as a barback, bartender, busser, and server, he makes an excellent boss. He's a confirmed bachelor, a ladies' man, and loves poker and golf and clamming out on Coteau. If there's a problem with George, it's that he knows too many people, some of them famous, Jimmy Buffett, and customers throw his name around like it's currency to get a better table or any table at all. But that's Nikki's problem, not Carson's. Carson has no complaints about George.
What are you on?
George asks.
Excuse me?
What are you on? George says. His expression is inquisitive rather than angry.
You just lost your mom in a tragic accident, Carson. You know what? My 16-year-old sister was killed by a drunk driver when I was in college, so I get it. I've been there. And because of that, I want to know what you're taking, because there's no way you can come back 2 weeks later to do a job that requires breakneck speed, laser focus, the patience of Mother Teresa, and a sense of humor without some kind of chemical help. Tell me the truth, please.
Tell him the truth? Carson wakes up every day around noon, brushes her teeth, then pours Kahlua into her coffee or drinks a screwdriver. For lunch, she smokes some weed or eats a magic cookie. Before work, she drinks 3 shots of espresso and snorts some cocaine. Sometimes that's too much. She can feel her heartbeat in her throat and her temples and her ass cheeks, so she tempers the high with a Valium. Some days, most days, she hits productive equilibrium. She comes to work and knocks down the crowd like she's John Dillinger with a machine gun. During work, there's more espresso and a bump or two in the ladies' room. After work, the serious drinking begins. A couple of cocktails first, shots, then beer. Then weed and an Ativan or a Valium to fall asleep.
I'm not on anything, she says.
She's surprised by how convincing she sounds.
I mean, I smoke a little weed on my day off, and I usually grab a drink after work.
But no oxy, no pills, no smack, George says.
No,
Carson says, sounding affronted, feeling affronted.
Oxy? Smack? Do I seem like a junkie to you, George, really?
George takes a visible breath. He's a lot grayer now than he was when Carson started here 3 years ago. But Carson likes the gray. Zach has some gray at his temples, and she finds it very sexy.
I've been in this business 38 years, so I have to ask. 1 drop, fine, accident. 2 drops, and I begin to think there's a problem.
I had a bad night, Carson says. That's allowed, isn't it?
She thinks back over her previous summers working at the Oyster Catcher.
What about when Gunner reached across the bar and jacked that guy up because of something he thought he heard? At least I didn't assault a customer.
You're right. Gunner had a temper, which was a liability I chose to ignore because he was a big draw. Handsome, charming, never forgot a drink, and because he made us so much money.
George points. You, Carson Quinborough, have the potential to be even better at this job than Gunner was. Carson reels back a little. This is high and unexpected praise. Gunner, Greg Gunn, is a living legend. He tended bar at the Oyster Catcher for 4 years until he was discovered by one of their hotshot customers who offered Gunner a job on Wall Street.
I don't know what to say. Thank you?
You're gorgeous. And I say that with all due respect, and no, I'm not hitting on you. You're a little cold, a bit indifferent, you're witty and quick but not flippant, you're tough on the barbacks, and you should be, they need to shape up. I heard about the card to lemon press for Jamie, that was a strategic move.
Carson smiles in spite of herself. I've been where they are, she says. I know how to manage them.
More than one person on the staff has come to me saying they think you're doing drugs in the bathroom, George says. You display a marked change in temperament when you return, they tell me.
Because I've relieved my aching bladder and gotten off my feet for 30 seconds.
If I find out it's true, or if you have another remarkably bad night like you did tonight,
Greg points a finger gun at her.
You're fired. Consider this your warning.
Carson walks through the dark parking lot to her mother's Jeep. She's so chastened that she skips her usual post-shift Corona, but not so chastened that she doesn't do a bump once she's safely in the car. The cocaine makes her angry. George says he understands because he lost his sister, but clearly he has forgotten how challenging it is to focus when your thoughts are soaked in grief like a bar towel that has fallen into the slop bucket.
"I lost my mother!"
Carson cries out. The tendons on her neck stand out. She's enraged.
"Someone killed her and drove away. I need her back."
Now the tears come, and the snot and the sadness impossibly deep. Carson will never stop being sad. The radio is playing "Stone in Love" by Journey.
No way.
This is the last song Vivi ever heard, one that Carson selected for her playlist because she had a long-ago memory of her mother turning it up on the radio and singing along. Carson sings now in an unhinged voice, wondering if somehow her mother is watching her. Maybe her mother had this song play on the radio to let Carson know that she's around, in the air, up above. Carson pulls out her phone and texts Zach.
"Meet."
There's no response. "Stone in Love" ends, and "Everybody Wants You" by Billy Squire begins. Carson is listening to Classic Rewind on Sirius XM because she's driving Vivi's Jeep, and these are Vivi's radio stations. No Shoes Radio, The Bridge, typical old person music. It's no great magic that Carson heard "Stone in Love" because this station plays Journey and other music from beyond the grave all the time. She's losing her mind. There's still no word from Zach. It's 10:45. He's probably asleep. Maybe Pamela came home from her little night out and they slept together. It happens occasionally, he admits, and Carson hates how much this bugs her. The agony is the price that she, and every other woman out there, must pay for falling in love with a married man. She wants to go out. She needs company, other people, even if they're nameless. She grabs some napkins out of the center console and mops her face. She lets her hair out of the tight braids and runs her fingers through the kinks. Earlier today, she bought a black paisley halter top at Erica Wilson. The shopping bag is in the back seat. She changes right there in the car. In the zippered pocket of her bag are her mother's silver Ted Mooling earrings. She takes them out and slides them through her ears. She has long coveted these earrings and on several occasions asked Vivi if she could borrow them. "No, you'll lose them. I know you, Carson." Carson had considered stealing them, but then decided her mother was right. Now they're hers. Everything is hers. She borrows Vivi's clothes, shoes, and jewelry. She sleeps in Vivi's bed. Why? Is she trying to become Vivi? Oh, who knows? Her mother had great taste, and the bed is comfortable. The earrings shine against Carson's dark hair. She's good to go. The line at the front door of the Chicken Box is long, but Carson, with her new cachet as head bartender at the Oyster Catcher, doesn't have to wait. She walks around to the back door, where the bouncer, Jerry, who is Nikki from Work's fiance, lets Carson right in and gives her a cold Corona while he's at it. The bar is packed. Bodies are crushed in so tight that Carson has to turn sideways and wedge herself between people in order to get to the row in front of the stage, where there is at least room to breathe. The band, Maxtone, is popular. They play cover tunes. The lead singer, Aaron, sees Carson and gives her a thumbs up. He and the band came into the Oyster Catcher the night before for dinner. Carson tips back her beer and tries to get lost in the song, "What I've Got" by Sublime. When the song ends, she takes a look at the other people in the front row and sees Greg Gunner, the legendary bartender, her predecessor, all the way in the corner. He's too dressed up for the box, nice white shirt, seersucker pants, and he's with some smoke show in what Carson thinks is vintage Stella McCartney. Carson sidles her way toward them to say hi, but then stops halfway because what if he doesn't remember her? It's too loud to explain who she is, and she'll end up making a fool of herself, which isn't at all appealing when her night has been so bad already. She should go home. But what's at home? Nothing. She needs another beer. She heads for the bar.
It's easier moving away from the stage than toward it, but when she tries to step around one guy, he moves in front of her. And when she tries to go the other way, he does too. Funny. She bares her teeth at him.
"Carson," he says.
It's what's-his-face from the field in Orr.
"Marshall," she says. "The duck."
He grins. He's lovely to look at. The same way a baby or a puppy is. Although here in the box with his Cisco Brewers t-shirt and his hat on backward over his golden curls and a little scruff on his cheeks. He must have had the day off because the field in Orr doesn't tolerate facial hair. He's more attractive than the last two times she's seen him.
"Look at you, Marshall."
She thinks about having a night of good old-fashioned fun with Marshall the duck. They can dance, make out, drive to the strip for a slice, go down to the public way by the galley to skinny dip, and then have sex on the beach.
This would be so refreshing, so clean,
so exactly the kind of night Carson should be having at the age of 21. Should she do it?
"Let me buy you a drink," she says.
"All set," he says, holding up a Miller Lite.
At that second, a little blonde in a Lily Pulitzer shift dress grabs Marshall's hand.
"Let's dance."
She turns and sees Carson.
"Hey, boo,"
she says, and Carson resists the urge to smack her.
"Sorry, he's mine tonight."
Marshall shrugs and lets the pipsqueak pull him through the crowd. Carson has no right to feel rejected. Marshall asked her out. She turned him down and threw away his number. But she does. He was looking good and felt exactly like what she needed. And she lost him to a blonde chew toy. She waits a second to see if Marshall will come back. When he doesn't, she turns to leave. Some guy grabs her ass on the way out, and Carson is so dejected, she can't even be bothered to hiss at him. Back in her Jeep, she checks her phone. Nothing from Zach. He's definitely sleeping. Well, he needs to wake up. She texts again. WYD. There's no response. There isn't going to be a response. He's asleep. He won't answer his cell and she can't call the house. She decides to do a drive-by. It's on her way home. She eases around the small rotary, on the lookout for the police. The way her night is going, she'll probably get pulled over and given a breathalyzer. She takes Hooper Farm down to Parker and turns right off Parker onto Gray Avenue. The Bridgman house is set back from the road about 100 yards. It's gambrel style and has a detached garage with a small apartment upstairs where Zach's son Peter now lives. Peter is away at camp. He's been going since he was 8 years old, and now he's the head counselor. Zach says that Peter fits in at the camp in a way he never fit in at Nantucket High School. Carson has heard way too much about the trials and tribulations of raising a teenager, considering that Carson is practically one herself. She pulls over into the parking spot of the deserted horse barn across the street. From here, she has a clear view of the house, which is dark except for the porch light and a light over the garage door. Carson is tempted to knock on the front door or throw pebbles at Zach's window. She looks at her phone again. Nothing. The heart is a lonely hunter, she thinks. Her namesake, Carson McCullers, had at least that much right. She leans back in her seat and closes her eyes. What is she doing? And how, oh how, did she get here? The affair started the previous November. Carson enrolled in a bartending class in South Boston. She would stay in Savannah's townhouse in Back Bay. Savannah was doing field work for her charity in Dakar, so Carson would have the place to herself. She had recently turned 21 and was ready for city life. She planned to run along the Charles, grab coffee from Thinking Cup, choose a museum or an outing for each afternoon, go to her bartending class, then eat out every night. She made a list of restaurants, Pammy's, Mistral, Area 4. She was flying from Nantucket to Boston on Cape Air on a 9-person Cessna. Zach Bridgman was also on her flight. When Carson saw him in the terminal, she waved and he waved back and smiled. She wondered if she had to go over and say hello or if she could just sit down and get lost in her music. The Bridgmans, Zach, Pamela, Peter, were now related to Carson through Willa. Seeing Zach was like seeing a distant uncle or a cousin twice removed. She thought it was good luck when she was assigned the seat behind Zach on the plane because there would be no need for conversation. As they were boarding the plane, they exhausted their only topic of conversation, where they were going. Zach was going to an air traffic control conference at the Boston Harbor Hotel. "Ooh," Carson said, genuinely impressed. "Fancy." Carson told Zach that she was taking a bartending class and staying in Savannah's townhouse on Marlborough Street.
"I should have been a bartender at some point," Zach said. "That has always felt like something I missed."
Carson was reminded then that Zach was friendly and kind. Carson steered clear of Pamela because she could be confrontational and negative. She likely would have told Carson to go back to school, get her degree, and make something of herself. The plane hit weather somewhere south of Boston, Plymouth maybe. Carson always tried to pick landmarks out on the ground to mark their progress, but all she could tell before they hit the squall was that they were somewhere over Route 3. The plane bounced around, and the rain sounded like gravel hitting the window. They were in the cotton ball. All Carson could see out the window was dense, dark cloud. The woman sitting behind the pilot reached for her barf bag. Carson was unconcerned. It was kind of fun, actually, like an amusement park ride. Sure enough, the plane emerged from the clouds into clear sky, the ground once more visible beneath them. Carson saw the skyline of Boston in the distance. Everyone relaxed. The pilot turned east, out over the water. Carson was jolted awake when the plane slammed down so hard that Carson thought they must have landed. But no, they were still in the air, back in the cotton ball. The turbulence was unlike any Carson had ever experienced. It felt like the plane was a cup of dice God was shaking. Carson's bag flew forward. The man to her left lost his file folders. The woman in the front seat puked again. The plane tipped sideways and went into a nosedive. They were plummeting and bouncing. Carson watched the pilot fight the wheel to raise the nose. The plane was going down. They were going to die. She reached forward and, almost involuntarily, grabbed Zach's hand.
"It's okay," he said. "He'll get us down. And if I see him get in real trouble, I'll assist. I can land this plane."
Carson was only somewhat comforted by this. She bent her head forward against Zach's seat back and let a stream of profanities fly. She thought of her mother, her father, her brother, and her poor sister, who had just miscarried for the second time. They would never recover. But that was only part of Carson's anxiety. The real meat of her fear was that she was so young and would never get to do so many of the things she wanted to. Live alone for 3 weeks in the city, eat at Pammy's, get her bartending certificate so she could be a boss at the Oyster Catcher the following summer. She wanted to travel to London at Christmas time, ride a motorbike across Thailand, see Serena Williams play in the Australian Open. She wanted to earn enough money to buy a little speedboat that she could take over to Koh Tu whenever she wanted. She had just turned 21 and had a lifetime of drinks to legally buy. She wanted to fall in love. Getting married and having children and sending out an annual Christmas card with her family's names printed in script across the bottom held zero appeal. But she liked the idea that someday she would find a man to be both friend and lover. So far, her men had been either one or the other. The plane tilted so far to the left that Carson was afraid it would start to spin. Zach said,
"We've caught the edge of a funnel cloud."
"A tornado?"
Carson said. She could feel how unstable the air was around them. She was holding on to Zach's fingers so tightly that she feared she might break them, and yet she could not let go. his wedding ring, made from a dark metal, pressed into her skin. The man who had lost his file folders was saying a prayer in Spanish.
"Fix this,"
Carson said to Zach. "Can you?" The plane was rumbling like a truck over a bumpy road and bouncing not only up and down, but sideways as well. The woman up front was crying. The pilot punched buttons and moved levers. Carson could see his lips moving. He was talking to the control tower in Boston.
"I think he's got it," Zach said.
But just then the plane dropped and everyone was bounced out of his or her seat. Carson's head grazed the ceiling. She started crying too and praying. She saw her life end in fiery ruins or in a drowning when they crashed into the ocean.
"Please, God, let this end. I'll go back to school. I'll study. I'll contribute to society. I'll be a good person. I'll win citizenship awards."
Suddenly, the runway appeared in front of them, and the plane, although still wobbly, headed right for it. The plane lowered. They were going to land.
"He's got it," Zach said.
And the plane touched down smoothly after all that. Carson released Zach's hand. All of her muscles were coiled so tightly that relief couldn't flow like it should. But then, yes, good energy flooded into her bloodstream and she felt dizzy with it. The tension in her neck eased. She was alive. They were taxiing to their gate. She was going to put her feet on planet Earth. Her plans would resume. But make no mistake, Carson was changed. She would never take anything for granted again. The pilot removed his headset.
"Sorry about the bumps," he said.
"Sorry about the bumps?" Carson whispered to Zach.
When they climbed the stairs to the terminal, Zach said,
"I don't know about you, but I need a drink."
"Hell yeah," Carson said.
"I would suggest walking down to legal and doing a shot, but it'll be packed. What time is your class?"
"Starts tomorrow," Carson said. "I'm free today."
"Let's have a drink at my hotel," Zach said. "My treat."
Carson thought to decline. She kind of wanted to get to Savannah's. She could go to any one of dozens of bars in Back Bay by herself. But she remembered her vow to be a contributing citizen, and she wasn't sure what she would have done if Zach hadn't been there to calm her.
"Sounds great," she said.
They shared an Uber to the Boston Harbor Hotel, which Carson had been to once as a kid. Vivi spoke at a luncheon, and Savannah brought Carson along to watch. Carson remembered the rotunda, the hushed elegance of the lobby, the huge floral arrangement on a central pedestal table, and the pretty soaps in the ladies' room. That was the first time Carson realized her mother was famous. A room full of people had applauded her. Zach said he would check in and drop his bags off in his room. He suggested Carson leave her bag at the bell desk, then go find them seats in the bar. The Rose Wharf Bar had a lot of dark polished wood and elaborate crown molding. There was a row of low tables with plush armchairs and cozy, rounded banquettes. The room glowed with golden light and felt like the perfect spot to spend a dreary autumn afternoon. Carson sat at a banquette table in the corner, and a waiter in black handed her a menu. Carson wondered if she would ever be able to work somewhere like this. It felt like a place where things happened. Business deals, love affairs. The prices on the menu were just south of staggering, but Zach had said he was paying, so Carson ordered a glass of Veuve Clicquot. Just then, Zach appeared.
"Make it a bottle," he said.
Their server brought a selection of bar snacks that looked too pretty to eat, as well as the chilled bottle, an ice bucket, and two flutes. Carson watched his elegant movements. He seemed to have four arms. The pop of the champagne cork gave her a shiver. She was alive to appreciate the pleasing sound of a champagne cork popping. Carson and Zach raised their flutes and touched them ever so gently together. Zach said,
"We made it."
They drank.
Carson said, "Were you worried?"
I was worried the pilot would panic and do something that would make him lose control of the plane. I would have taken co-pilot and gotten us down.
You should have.
I wasn't needed, except by you.
He poured them each some more champagne and said,
I thought I was going to lose a couple of fingers.
There were no sexual or romantic feelings for Carson at first, just a sense of camaraderie. And then, as they ordered a second bottle of champagne and a burger to share with double fries, a sense of conspiracy. Carson Quinborough and Zach Bridgman were hanging out, wasting an afternoon getting drunk in a fancy hotel bar. Zach was easy to talk to. Carson heard about how he'd graduated from MIT with a degree in aeronautical engineering, then came to Nantucket to work for the summer before doing a master's at Rensselaer. During that summer, he worked at the yacht club and was targeted by Pamela Bonham. He was then fast-tracked into the Bonham family and a life on Nantucket. By fast-tracked, you mean?
I got Pamela pregnant.
Ah, Carson said. You were so young.
Yes, my friend, yes, I was. It wasn't the life I'd planned, but I've made it work. I enjoy ATC. I like flying myself when I can. I love Nantucket. I'd be a jerk to complain.
Their server appeared and asked if he could bring them anything else. By that point, Carson was well on her way to being drunk, and although she knew the proper thing was for her to thank Zach, collect her bag, and summon an Uber, she noticed something in Zach's expression, a crack in the friendly, confident facade. Maybe he wanted to be a jerk. Maybe he wanted to complain. And if so, Carson wanted to hear it. She said,
I think I'm going to switch to a cocktail.
She fully expected Zach to tactfully say that they'd had enough and that he had places to be. But he didn't even hesitate.
I'll join you. A Maker's Mark on the rocks for me and...
Belvedere, tonic, lemon, please.
When did she realize she wanted to sleep with him? Maybe a couple of sips into her Belvedere and tonic when she excused herself to go to the ladies' room, and Zach stood up. Her father always did this as well, and Carson loved a man with old-fashioned manners. Every boy she'd ever dated reached for his phone before she'd even left the table. Maybe it was a moment later when, sitting on the toilet, Carson considered texting Willa to say, "You are never going to believe who I'm getting drunk with right now." Carson knew not to say anything to Willa because Willa would tell Rip and Rip would tell Pamela, and what was electric about the afternoon was that Carson and Zach were forging a bond without anyone in their respective families knowing about it. One cocktail became two. Before they ordered a third, Zach said,
I think I should send you on your way before something indiscreet happens.
Carson, emboldened by the mere suggestion that something indiscreet might happen, slid over on the banquette until she was close enough to feel the warmth coming off Zach's body. He was old, yes, in his 40s, but he was kind of hot, and he was so nice and smart. He had an engineering degree from MIT, and he'd been such a hero to her on the plane. And this was the first day of Carson's new independent adult life, and the best plot twists, as her mother would say, occurred when you least expected them. That was what made them twists.
I suppose you've heard I'm the black sheep of the family.
I've always thought you were the most intriguing, Quinborough. And today proved me right.
Did it?
Carson let her hand fall lightly on Zach's thigh, which was very bad and very bold. He picked her hand up, kissed it, and said,
You're extremely beautiful, Carson. But I'm married and a father, and you're half my age.
But we nearly died, Carson said. We should be celebrating life. I feel like something should happen now.
Zach signaled for the check.
What happens now is you go to Savannah's, and I'll see you back on Nantucket at Thanksgiving. Willa is hosting, right?
Right.
We probably shouldn't tell anyone about today.
Except we're not doing anything wrong, Carson said. You're rejecting my advances.
Zach squeezed her hand.
Someday you'll thank me for rejecting your advances. Nothing good could come of this, not for me and not for you either.
Zack paid the bill, then escorted Carson to the lobby and waited while the bellman retrieved her bag. He took care of tipping the bellman, which was such a kind and generous thing to do that Carson fell even deeper into her infatuation.
"Shall I wait with you while your Uber comes?" he asked outside the hotel.
"Please don't," Carson said. "I'll be fine." Zack kissed her once, gently, on the lips. It fell somewhere between a romantic kiss and an avuncular one.
"Thank you. That was the best afternoon I've had in a long time."
"It could get better," Carson said. Zack laughed and disappeared through the revolving door. Carson waited for a few addled seconds as she tried to read that kiss. Then she canceled her Uber and dragged her bag back into the lobby. She moved straight for the elevator bank. She was grateful that some other dude, who gave her a not-so-subtle up and down, had a key card that made the elevator rise.
"What floor?" he asked.
11, she said. Zack's key card, still in its little cardboard jacket, had been sitting between them on the table all through lunch. Room 1112. She rolled her bag down the thick carpet of the hallway to Zack's door. She stood quietly for a second and, just like they say happens in the moments before death, Carson's life passed before her eyes. She saw all of the bad and naughty things she'd done in her life. Slapping Willa across the face, stealing Tic Tacs from the Stop and Shop, calling her mother a bitch, telling Amy she had a fat ass, starting the bad rumor about Juliana Corti in sixth grade, vaping, smoking weed, stealing her mother's Jeep and going for a joyride on Maya Comet Golf Course, doing a beer bong at 3 a.m. at the Pike House, and then having sex with a fraternity president in the hall coat closet, failing all but one course first semester sophomore year, generally being a smart aleck, high maintenance, a relentless attention seeker, and the squeaky wheel. But nothing Carson had done in her 21 years compared to this. She knocked. A second later, Zack answered. Did he look surprised to see her?
"No. I watched you from the window," he said, his voice now husky.
"And?" He stared at her for a long second, so long that Carson wondered if he was running through his own worst moments. Then he sighed and held open the door. Carson is startled out of her memories by a pair of headlights creeping slowly down Gray Avenue. She squints. It's very late now, past 1. Who is this? She catches a glint of red and sees the outline of the Range Rover. It's Pamela. Carson is about to get busted lurking outside the Bridgman house. How will she